Hi there, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Vulcan Knowledge. I'm delighted today to be joined by my friend and prior colleague, Diamond Takara. She is a PhD researcher at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and she's joining us live today from a very sunny and hot Honolulu morning. Hi, Diamond.
Hi, everyone. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us today. So Diamond is a hydrogeologist, and you do some really, really fascinating research combining aspects of hydrology, geology, even volcanology. So it'd be great to just hear a bit about your background, how you've got to where you are today, and then we can just go from there.
Sure, yeah. I actually wanted to go into geoscience since I was in middle school. My passion, I guess, started after I saw a movie about earthquakes in eighth grade. And I thought that was fascinating. And so I wanted to be a seismologist. Then I got into college and into the geoscience program. And then I went through like the whole gamut of wanting to do different things in geoscience, from, you know, coastal geology, looking at the way that sand moves across the shoreline during different storm events. I did experimental petrology for an internship. And then I also did an internship for hydrology with the USGS here in Honolulu. And after all of those different experiences, I think what really stood out to me was that doing hydrology really allowed me to focus on research that impacts my community. And that, you know, that's a big part of what geoscience is part of my passion, is doing science for my community as a Native Hawaiian. And so, that's kind of how I got here, with a whole lot of mentoring from other people along the way, and just kind of winging it.
Brilliant. And you've been at the University of Hawaii for this entire time, so you've been able to experience all these different groups, but all in the same place, and as you say, being able to give something back to your local community on so many levels.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how, you know, you don't really think about it, but that's what makes the University of Hawaii such a special place, is that you basically have everything that's related to geoscience. Maybe there's not much oil here, right? But everything else is basically here. And so, yeah, if you're interested in geoscience, Hawaii is the best place to be, I think.
There you go. That's a selling line if anyone's ever heard it. we've got oceans, we've got coastline, we've got mountains, we've got volcanoes.
Yep, we've got crazy climate.
and much more.
Yeah.
So this aspect of hydrology, what exactly were you working on during this internship that really captivated your interest in this area?
Yeah, so the USGS here, they really focus on monitoring precipitation, especially how, you know, things are changing with climate change. And also really checking the stream flow and stream height, at least here on Oahu, because that's such a big factor when we do have hurricanes and storms that pass by. All of our flash flooding is really crazy. And so basically it's, you know, being aware of what base flow is in order to prepare for when you do have these crazy storms that drop 10 inches of rain and then start to flood your coastal communities. And then really bringing all of that gross water down into the ocean, and how are we really impacting our coastlines, not just, you know, from the intense amount of rain, but also all of our runoff from our industrial areas, our wastewater and things like that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So as you say, you're really able to get involved in something that's so local and so directly impacts, but that's now, for you, led on to a research direction in a similar kind of field, similar area, but not actually based on Oahu anymore. So your research is based over on the Big Island of Hawaii,
correct,
where the most active volcanoes and the most prominent and probably most familiar volcanoes are.
Yeah, so my research is on the Big Island, basically the entire northwestern half. So down from Waimea all the way to Kealakekua, and from the Kona coast all the way inland to the summits of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. So a good half of the Big Island.
Good half of the Big Island. So over on Big Island, we've got five volcanic centers. Okay. So we've got Kilauea, Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea, Hualalai, and Kohala.
Correct.
And those are the ones on land. So But what you're doing with your research is actually looking at how the rainfall is influenced by the volcanoes themselves.
Yeah, that's part of it. So basically, my entire dissertation is looking at the water cycle of the Big Island, at least the western half, and how the geochemical changes in every step of the water cycle can tell us about where the water is coming from, how it's flowing in the ground, what the water looks like when it comes out at the coastlines for our ecosystems. And so, because Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa are so tall, they really affect the weather patterns for the Big Island. And so, like, for a long time, people always said hurricanes are going to basically die because the volcanoes will kill it. Like, it's, they really just like shear off the top of the clouds. And so the Big Island is a really dynamic place, and there's, every kind of climate that you can think of. And yeah, the weather patterns for the east side versus the west side are really different.
Okay, so you're looking at these chemical changes in the water that you're seeing at the coastlines. What sort of chemical changes are you looking for? Is that influenced by the rock itself? Is it something that changes from source all the way to, well, from source all the way to surface, I guess.
Yeah, so I looked at the chemistry of rainfall and what is the baseline, I guess, for what a water droplet would look like. And then we can basically track a water droplet from the elevation that it falls at and look at how its chemistry changes because it's really leaching different chemical species like sodium, potassium, magnesium from the rocks that it's flowing through. And the longer the flow path to where you pump the water out, the higher the content of those different species will be. And then an added impact is the stuff that we put in the ground. So all of our fertilizer, the wastewater from our homes, all of those things really get added in. So you can start to see this imbalance in chemistry as you start to get to civilization. And then at the coastlines, we really see big changes based on how the population is and how much new excess nutrients are flowing into the ocean. Yeah,
Okay, so I was just wondering, so is that actually directly impacting the water quality that is then used by the populations on the coastline? It's not
no.
just a question of, oh, we can track the chemistry of the rainfall and that's it. It actually has a direct impact.
Yeah. And so, on at least on the mainland and in other parts of the world, you see these really gross algal blooms every once in a while, in the summertime, I think. And that's really because of all the excess nutrients that we as humans are putting into our groundwater system. And so when we have these big algal blooms, they really suck the oxygen out of the ocean, and then all of our fish die. And there's you can actively see these imbalances causing big changes in our ecosystems and what we rely on for food and economics and yeah, so it's a lot of pressure to study it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, as you say, you're at the forefront of this field that's able to is directly applicable to what communities need to know. And it's research that can be applied almost the next day in that sense. You produce data and it goes through review and processing, but once it's there and you know what the data is showing you, that is there a part of your program that is about actually translating your knowledge to the community and to, like civil authorities?
Yeah, so for the last, gosh, how long have I been in grad school? So I guess for the last 5 years through my dissertation, a lot of what I do is like a back and forth with the community that we work with. And so I've been doing quarterly sampling for a couple years now, and every time we do a new sampling trip to collect our new samples, I try to sit down with our whoever we're working with for like 5 or 10 minutes, kind of update them on the geochemistry that we're seeing, see if they have any questions. And as a local kid, I don't try to, I mean, I also, the imposter syndrome is real, but the being able to translate to your community what what are the concerning things for you as a scientist, and how can we continue to work together beyond my dissertation for my career, and make sure that my career is actually rooted in what my community needs. Instead of the wow. science for the sake of science kind of thing, I really want to do something that matters.
Yeah. I was going to say, it must feel very fulfilling knowing that what you're doing is having that impact and able to change the way your communities think about the way they interact with the natural world.
Yeah. And a big part of it too is, you know, preparing for climate change. That's always the biggest question now. How is this going to look in 10 years, 20 years? And that's what I'm hoping to work on for my postdoc. But, you know, it's a scary question here when you already have, you know, we've already been seeing impacts of sea level rise and different, you know, rainfall patterns. And it's a really scary thing to think about, that maybe we'll lose a yeah. lot of our cultural resources that are at the coastline in 50 years.
Yeah. And these systems that you're working on, obviously the volcanoes of Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea, as you say, they're such huge edifices, and so that water that's entering the systems at high elevation,
yeah,
it takes a long time for that to get down to the coastline. So I think when a lot of people think about, you know, where does my water come from, where's the groundwater coming from, oh, it rained the other day, so that means we've got a lot of water stored,
right?
It's not the case. Rain is old,
right? Yeah.
Or it can be old.
Yeah Our groundwater systems are really old. So if anybody listening has ever gone up to Waikoloa, a village on the Big Island, you are drinking water that is on the order of thousands of years old. Like, I would say 3,000 to 5,000 years old. And that's older than Hawaiians were even here. And so that, wow. We're drinking water before my kupuna, my ancestors, even crossed the Pacific. And so when we talk about,
that's incredible.
When we talk about climate change, it's really thinking about, okay, how are we now as humans, as Kanaka in Hawaii, affecting what is going to be available for our children in 3,000 years?
Many, many years down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just a tomorrow or next week
right.
problem in this sense. When we think about, as you say, impacts of climate change, we're normally thinking on this generation and the next generation and a little bit further, but this is actually something we have to consider for a very, very far in the future.
Yeah. So a lot of that groundwater in the Waikoloa area is, you know, it's on the order of thousands of years old. And even the younger groundwaters that we find up there, they're still hundreds of years old. So even then, you know, and to be fair, other parts of the world, they do see recharge maybe on the order of a couple decades. And so, you know, those generational conversations about the impacts of climate change make a lot of sense. But here it's a really, really deep groundwater system that, you know, I mean, we can't even fathom what's going on because it's so deep.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it just really, really solidifies thinking about how people on the island, people who have been living there for hundreds, a couple of thousand years, have built this relationship with the natural world around them over the years. And of course, their native Hawaiian culture is, it's not even just tied to the environment. The culture is the environment. It is the world around it.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, thinking about that, a big part of what I've done for the last 5 years is use an olelo no'eau as which is a Native Hawaiian proverb, as kind of the driving goal of my research. And the olelo no'eau is ola ikawai akaupua, which translates to there's life in the water from the clouds.
Wow.
And that, to me, like, knowing that my kupuna, my ancestors, knew that and could recognize that because they had to have such a deep, you know, understanding and relationship with every aspect of the environment, that just tells you that they cared for it so much, you know, and and how have we really changed as a society from looking at our environment as, you know, my kupuna looked at it as a source of where we get our wealth and our health. Nowadays, we talk about it as a resource, something that we take from and that we utilize. And if we want to save our planet, we have to go back to the mindset that the environment that we live in is a source and that we don't matter to it, right? Like, it's going to live beyond we will. And so we really have, our job is to protect it and develop that relationship.
Volcanology is supported by Geology for Global Development. It's a UK-based charity which champions the role of geology in sustainable development. Their aim is to mobilise and reshape the global geology community to help deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You can find out more about the work of GFGD by visiting their website www.gfgd.org or following them on social media.
There's using the environment around you, but then there's also having to deal with the aspects of geohazards. Of course, when we look at somewhere like Kilauea, which has been active for, well, thousands and thousands of years going back, but has been active well before the island was first settled by Native Hawaiians, that, as you said, that aspect has always been there and that we've just had to work around it. But even then, the relationship we have, say, with volcanic eruptions at Kilauea is very different to how it was treated back throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, my research isn't really on the Kilauea side, but you know, when you think about Hualalai, the last eruption was in the late 1800s when people were here. And there are stories, which we call mo'olelo, and I mean, stories doesn't do it justice. It's history that's documented through oral tradition. And so there, it's fact that of what happened, right? The eruption happened, but it's told in a very beautiful, like melodic way, almost like it's, you know, there's a story about Pele. Pele is the lava that flows from Hualalai and comes down into a village and destroys a house of a girl who won't share her dinner, and saves the house of another girl who does share her dinner. And it really talks about the speed at which the lava flow happened, because it was, you know, the viscosity was so different, and you know, all the, I'll let Sam talk about the volcanology, but you know, the mo'olelo side of it really is how we captured our history and that relationship between humans and what was happening in our aina, in our place, and how can we use that kind of information, not in an extractive way, but how can we as scientists look to our past and the people who were here to really understand what might happen in the future?
Yeah, it's really, I love the way that you put that, and it's not just a usual form of, you know, documentation as we would do now. We make our observations, but it's then taking that and using it to influence your education, your teachings, how you can teach, you know, you could use a volcanic eruption to teach children about morals.
Right.
from those narratives. And it's translated into other parts of Hawaiian culture as well, like into hula. Mm-hmm. As well, so I think when, you know, I think for a lot of people, you know, there's a preconceived idea of what hula actually is, but it's all a part of mo'olelo. It's a deep part of connecting with culture and telling people about these narratives, through something that people can physically observe.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about it, you know, hula and mele or songs. Mm-hmm. It's really my kupuna's way of sharing the history and the relationship that for so many years, like that they've had with the environment, in a way that, you know, for us as kids, right? We learn song and dance as kids as a way to remember different things. And so it's always been a great way to translate information across generations. And for us, you know, we're so far removed from generations that may have developed a song about an eruption or about a, you know, some kind of event in, you know, the, you know, a moment in Hawaiian history, but we can still feel the feelings and the intensity of that from the songs and the chants and the way that we do our hula and physically moving our bodies to embody these different things. And you know, you talked a lot about education, and I think that you know, geoscience is a way for us to get some more local kids into leadership positions here, because who better than the descendants of our kupuna to make the decisions about what's happening in our place?
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that. Obviously, it's so important for local kids to have this education and to have it from local native voices, and as you say, to pass that down and to continue that culture. But is it something that's actively pursued and pushed within education to encourage children? It's like, look at where you are and what's around you.
Yeah, I think, you know, now there is a new resurgence of Hawaiian pride. You know, we have this resurgence of Hawaiian language, and a lot of that has to come from, you know, the way that Hawaiians were treated after the overthrow, and the way that our language was almost erased and our culture was trying to be erased. And so we have this resurgence, which is a really great moment in time. It's happening perfectly with our concerns about climate change and our changing political, whatever, climate, whatever you want to call it. And I really think that, you know, in the next 10 years, we'll have so many more leaders who are born from the islands. And I hope that, you know, in the next 10 years, I see more kids who are like me, who come through, you know, not just the public education system from middle and high school, but through our university system, because, you know, there's no better place to learn about Hawaii than in Hawaii, and being able to focus my research here and connect with my community on such a deep level. I hope that as we move forward in time, that the relationships between the university and our community can be repaired. But, you know, that's a whole deeper thing about, you know, self-reflection and all of that. But, you know, I really think that our university is in a position to create and nurture the next generation of Kanaka leaders who will be making policy and climate decisions for Hawaii.
Yeah. And when it's teaching about the Mo'olelo and native culture, it's not just a fixed box. It's continuously evolving. We only need to look back 3 years ago and even to the present day. You know, Kilauea had a huge eruption in 2018 that severely impacted communities, destroying hundreds of homes, and has been a cornerstone and a turning point in volcanology anyway, and how we deal with risk and hazards, just like, say, the Mount St. Helens 1980 eruption was. So are events like that in Hawaii actually influencing a continuation of Mo'olelo? So are there already, say, new... Is a new hula, a mele from that eruption, say, and from continued events?
You know, I'm not sure. That's a really great question. I would think so. You know, when people who are in my generation become kupuna, when we're 60, 70, 80 years old, and we talk to our grandkids, who knows what Kilauea will be doing at that point? And we'll be telling our kids, you know, I'll be telling my grandkids, when the 2018 eruption happened, I was on the Big Island and I was doing field work, and I collected samples throughout that entire, you know, pre-eruption, during eruption, post-eruption period. And I saw the physical changes in the environment and how the rainfall patterns changed because there was no more Vogue in Hawaii. And
also, you were actively collecting. You were still doing your research. Yeah. You're actually collecting the rainfall.
Yeah.
Throughout the window prior and after the eruption.
Yeah, and you know, even just talking to the people who live in Kona and how, you know, after the eruption ended, almost every single person I talked to said, this has been the rainy season in the last 50 years. And, you know, of course, there's been really rainy seasons before that. But during the period that Kilauea was erupting, even just at Pu'u'o'o and at the crater, you know, not the big event that happened in 2018, there was still fog in Hawaii. And that fog in the atmosphere has an impact on rain's ability to condense into rainfall and actually rain. And so once the eruption ended, you know, there's a good chance, there's a high probability that that cessation of volcanic activity allowed all of this rainfall to happen. And Kona was green. Like if you are familiar with the Big Island, Kona was overgrown and just weeds everywhere, grass anywhere that there was soil. It was amazing.
And just from the eruption ending and of that volcanic fog, the fog from Kilauea, all of Kilauea had been ongoing for decades.
Yeah.
And so that change in weather pattern was something very, very drastic, literally as a result of Kilauea switching off. And it stayed that way for, well, until the end of 2020, pretty much, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was hardly any VOG output for about 18 months.
Yeah. And, you know, my sinuses.
No, longer than that, 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. My sinuses greatly appreciated that.
Yeah. So I think that's just an amazing example of how all these different systems across geoscience, from volcanism to atmospherics, meteorology, and rainfall, vegetation, everything is connected. And it can just be one sudden change that an eruption stopping on one side of the island actually caused the other side of the island to flourish.
Right. Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's, yeah, I'm so lucky to be here and be able to witness it all.
Yeah, and then bringing that back to how that influences culture and what then gets passed on. It's all of those aspects mm-hmm. that get included in that narrative that gets passed down.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite things about going to the Big Island and talking to people is getting to absorb the knowledge from the kupuna who are there. And so that thing that I said about source versus resource, that's straight from the mouth of Uncle Mike. I mean, he, you know, we sat down one day and he told me about that. And I, you know, I was shocked at how simple, but that's reality. He's 100% correct. And it's not something I've ever thought about even as a scientist or a local kid, you know, but just hearing that's the observations of my kupuna, that we've changed how we view our environment. That's the kind of information that our ancestors are passing down to us.
Wow. Really, really, yeah, really, really nice way to put that. As you say, sometimes it takes a voice that either you're not expecting or that you wouldn't normally necessarily always go to mm-hmm. just change your complete perspective of yeah. how not just we interact with the environment, but how we perceive it, how we appreciate it, how we praise it, how we're in awe of how little we matter in that sense to yeah. these processes that are happening around us.
Yeah. I mean, how little we matter, but also how big of an impact we are having, you know, it's yeah. crazy. Life is crazy.
Well, on the line that life is crazy, this has been really, really fascinating. It's been amazing to hear that insight into local culture and the influence and the importance of native voices for native local education, as well as the education for others that come to the island, and then translating those stories to a global audience as we begin to think about these, well, as they begin, as we think, as we continue to tackle these problems such as climate change. Yeah. And so to wrap things up today, I just want to ask you if there's some experience in your life, something that's really memorable that you've taken away from your experience living on volcanic island, living, growing and working on volcanic islands.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when you grow up here, you really take it for granted, right? Like, you grow up surrounded by volcanoes and the different dynamic systems that they create and that they influence. And it's only during my PhD that I've really started to appreciate it. I mean, I've always appreciated living here, but really appreciating how my kupuna, my ancestors, viewed this place. And so, you know, when I was doing field work, I got to go up to the summit of Hualalai, which is a place not many people get to go to.
Wow.
And I stood out over this kind of lookout area that, I mean, it's not a lookout, it's just a cliff. And you look over the saddle area towards Mauna Kea. So you look over that saddle region between Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, and Hualalai. And thinking about the different names of the different places, the different ahupua'as or land divisions that my kupuna created and worked in, and how they're so descriptive of their water resources and water availability, and thinking about Ola Ikawai Akaupua, and just living in that moment of collecting water samples that, you know, that are falling during my time, collecting water samples that are falling, that fell before my ancestors even arrived here. Just like, I had to stand there and just breathe because I couldn't do anything else. And it was so magical. And I will never forget that moment, and just looking out into this vast openness and, you know, thinking about how my ancestors knew how everything was connected and just had this relationship with everything. And it was a beautiful moment that I will never forget, and that, you know, I hope I get to experience again post-COVID. But it's a lot of thinking and a lot of feeling and trying to put myself in my kupuna's shoes, in a sense.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate that. That's, as you said, that's something, a very, very deep connection, not just to the world around you, but from the people who have come before us as well, and how they connected to our environment.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Diamond, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. This was a really neat experience.
No problem at all. Well, for anybody interested about Diamond's work, you'll be able to see the links to some of the things that she's been working on, and you can follow her through her journey in science.
Thank you so much. Thank you for letting me share all of my stories, and I hope that it resonated with some people.
Absolutely. I'm sure it will have done. Thank you, Diamond, and enjoy the rest of your day over in sunny Hawaii.
Yes, thank you. Good night to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Volcan Knowledge, hosted by Sam Mitchell and produced by Hugh James with Anturus Education. This series was supported through the American Geophysical Union's Sharing Science program, and you can catch more of our episodes and information on our guests on our website, www.volcanknowledge.com, or follow us on social media at Volcan Knowledge through Twitter and Instagram.